The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast for March 30th. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome. Well, the subject never changes, does it?
Yeah, it's always COVID. You know, I was thinking about it the other day. March 7th is really the day that everything changed. That's when that OPEC price war and the ramping up of COVID outside of China really started to take off. It's actually 3 weeks ago.
It's been 3 weeks ago. Yeah. It feels like 3 months. And it's been another eventful weekend with the numbers for COVID going up in the United States, but sort of some good news in terms of looking over the shoulder over the Atlantic into Europe. Some of the numbers are starting to flatten out in the countries that have been hardest hit, places like Spain, Italy. In some countries like Switzerland, the numbers even look like convincingly coming down on a daily new cases per day basis. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think we're going to see more and more positive results coming out of these shelter in place or shelter at home type of things going forward. And that's all positive. And so we've seen the incidence of the pandemic go basically full circle around the world.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. I was just showing a map actually last week. Now we're talking about lockdown procedures. Before, we were mainly talking about US, North America, and Europe. Mm-hmm. But now you've got them in South America. Mm-hmm. You've got them in places in Africa. You've got them in now Russia, actually, as of today. It looks like Moscow was doing mm-hmm. that, but now they're considering countrywide lockdowns as well. And so a bigger and bigger part of the world is being impacted by this, with obviously consequences to oil demand.
I think it's like 177 countries are now affected, which is pretty much every country in the world. So we've got a lot of statistics that are coming out, but, you know, candidly, not enough. And this is one of the problems, is that active cases in one country are defined differently than in other countries. The testing procedures range from a phone call, are you okay, call us if you get worse, to swabs and actual medical lab confirmations. So it's really hard to know what the total number of cases really are. And that leads to some problems in terms of interpreting the data for policymakers in terms of when we hope to be able to ease the restrictions and get back to work. But I'll come to that in a minute. I think that the data problem is now being recognized by many institutions and others. It's a bad news, good news thing. The bad news is the pandemic is sweeping around the world. The good news is that as it sweeps and more people get infected and more people recover, and unfortunately more and more people die, you get more and more statistics. And the good news, if there is any in all of this, is that it appears as though the initial estimates of the death rate of about 3-4% of people who catch it is substantially higher than it probably really is, you know, depending upon the various agencies that you listen to. It sounds like it's more like 1% or less than 1%. In other words, a 1 in 100 chance that you will actually die if you catch it. And also there's, of course, demographic considerations. Older people with pre-existing conditions are still the most susceptible. Okay, that's all fine and good statistically. The issue, though, is that depending upon the healthcare systems of the various countries and jurisdictions, there is a surge of patients that come flooding into the hospitals, into the ICUs, and clog it up and create general panic and havoc. And that is really the problem that will probably continue over the course of the next 2 to 3 weeks. But within 2 weeks, and, you know, there's sort of this universal convergence now of opinion that the next 2 weeks are going to be very telling from a statistics standpoint, from what do we do next standpoint. And I tend to agree. We've been talking about the next few weeks as being really pivotal. And I think that given the starting to the rollover in the European countries, that we will start to see some clarification with more statistics from which we can infer what to do next.
Right. And the University of Oxford study was pretty impactful last week that came out, and it talked about the fact, you talk about that it was 3-4% and now it's 1. Well, we always kind of can measure the deaths. The problem is we just didn't know how many people actually have it. And depending on the country, they're not testing enough to really know how widespread it is. But this Oxford study was focused on the UK, said that many more people may have already been infected. and that the inconsistency of the death rates around the world are part of that. Mm-hmm. And so basically they're saying way more people have this than you think, which is actually a positive in that the faster this thing moves through the population,
yeah,
the faster we have the immunity as a society and we can move on. So I thought that was positive, you know, that maybe the duration isn't maybe as long as you'd think if it goes more slowly.
Yeah, that's right. The challenge is the sensationalism of the disease has created widespread anxiety and, you know, outright panic in some places. And therefore, the exit ramp, so to speak, of how you get people back to work is potentially going to be difficult to execute. You're right. I mean, there's probably more people than we know that have had it, as further to not only the Oxford study, some work I've done out of Stanford that you can follow on YouTube, but the issue is, how do we know who has had it and who is immune and who isn't without testing? And so that's why the testing is so key. Testing not only whether you currently have it or testing whether or not you actually have the antibodies against the virus and therefore are immune. And so presumably if you're immune, you can go back to work. However, what do? Do you have to have some kind of certificate that says, yes, you know, I've had the test before you can go back to work? We don't know. But first thing is to get the numbers, and we hope that those will start to appear in greater quantity and also with greater, I would call it, comprehensiveness over the course of the next 2 weeks. So, you know, I want to talk about the different phases that we've seen this pandemic go through. You know, the first phase is one of early warning and denial, right? Well, we're well past that. I think denial ended, I would say, depending on what country you're in, a week to 2 weeks ago. And then that went into shock and awe, you know, the shock and the awe of seeing the patients in the Italian hospitals and all the people in hazmat suits in Asia and mm-hmm. in Europe and so on. And then sort of the realization that, okay, if we lock down, we are going to start to see some better numbers. I think we're now just entering into that phase. And I would say we're certainly in Europe moving quite rapidly, I would say within a week to 10 days, probably in what I would call the adaptation and crisis management phase. In other words, much more of a management of the issue rather than panic and overall seemingly hopeless, never-ending exponential growth of the disease. And then finally, the phase that Asia is already in is sort of the retreat of the pandemic, coordinated management and prevention, and then getting back to work. Unfortunately, here in North America, especially the United States, we're probably a week to 10 days behind Europe. And so the next couple weeks, some of the government officials in the United States are suggesting next 3 weeks, I tend to agree, are going to be pretty rough.
Mm-hmm. Well, Trump just came out recently and said that they're extending these social distancing measures until the end of April.
Yeah.
So we're a month away, as far as he thinks. And he also says that peak death rate may happen in a few weeks.
Yeah, I think that that's probably going to be a turning point. But the thing is spreading so rapidly and the numbers are coming in so rapidly. And we now have enough experience, certainly in Western countries, that we're starting to understand the recovery rates as well, which seem to be actually pretty encouraging. So as it went around the world, first Asia, then Europe, and then North America, including Canada, United States, the United States growing quite rapidly, also on a much larger base of population. We shall see, I think, in the next 2 weeks, a lot more data and a lot more knowledge of how to manage the crisis and then understand what the term they're using, the exit ramps off of the crisis back into some sort of organized reintroduction of work into the economy.
Okay. Yeah. So the problem now is what it means for oil demand. And, you know, it's a busy days to be an oil price forecaster, Peter. It seems like every couple of days I'm revising what I said a few days ago, like many people
these days. What is the definition, I don't know if definition is the right word, of what is the value of a price forecast today?
Maybe the currency, you mean?
Yeah.
Probably 2 days is what I'm finding.
Yeah.
And so you know how last week I said that the consensus view was out there that there'd be 10 million barrels a day of oil demand lost, and the odd person said 15. And now the consensus, I mean, it's such a consensus view that the IEA even said it, the 20 million barrels a day drop right now.
Off of 100.
Of 100. And yeah. other estimates as high as 26 million barrels a day right now. So yeah. every week we just keep losing more. And it makes sense, right? Like if we're losing economic activity in such broad swaths of the world, including yeah. South America, the Middle East, North America, it's going to have a big implication for world demand.
Let's just back up and think about it. Pretty much every border is closed in the world. International air travel is halted. So,
and even a lot of domestic travel slowing down.
And mm-hmm. then you look at a webcam of any major city in Europe or in the United States, and you can just see that the traffic is so much lighter than it usually is. No traffic jams. And so the gasoline consumption has just retreated as everybody is sheltered yeah. in place at home and basically not going to work, yeah. not commuting.
Some estimates are gasoline demand in the U.S. is down by half, mm-hmm. Which is realistic considering how little people sure. are doing. And so in the U.S., which continues to be a major focus for my work and our work in looking at Canadian oil prices, most estimates are that U.S. demand in total down about 6 million barrels a day or 30%. As I said last week, I'm looking at those key signposts, which are refinery run rates, and also the volumes of oil being stored at Cushing, which is a key hub for Canadian oil.
That's in Oklahoma.
Yeah, and if you look at all the pipelines that leave Western Canada, the vast majority of them somehow get tied into the central part of the U.S., which eventually can get into Cushing. And so I'm very interested to see how inventories start to build in that key hub. So far, as of the most recent data, nothing happening, but I think it's happening real time right now, and we'll start to see it in this week's data. We have lots of examples of refineries in the U.S. that are cutting their runs. For example, Valero talked about cutting about 15% of its runs in about half of its refineries last week, saying that deeper cuts are coming this week. I've heard numbers as big as 50% run cuts in some refineries. Sure. It's just there's no demand for their product, nowhere to put it, so they're going to have to turn down the rate of throughput in their refineries. We have one example of a refinery, actually the Come By Chance refinery in Newfoundland, which has actually stopped operations altogether. Mm-hmm. It's coming, and I think over the next few weeks, we'll really see the impact of that on the storage at Cushing and also the refinery runs in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, the prices in Texas for oil, especially the inland,
they're also being discounted heavily.
Yeah. I mean, they have a differential relative to the hub price, right?
They do. And as they get jammed up, they're going to see that as too.
Right.
Now, last week, we spent a lot of time talking about this is all going to cause shut-ins in Canada. And we put out an estimate of about 1 million barrels a day of supply. I'd used actual production numbers when I said mm-hmm. it, but that's the equivalent to about 1 million barrels a day of supply that we thought could potentially be shut in Western Canada as they don't have as much demand. Other analysts came out over the course of last week, and the range of estimates is anywhere between 1 to 2 million barrels a day. So ours is kind of on the lower end.
That's for Canada or for?
For Western Canada.
1 to 2 million barrels a day.
Of shut-ins. Yeah. So that would be 20 to 40% of all Canadian crude supply. So we are still anticipating that we're going to have to see quite a few shut-ins. We haven't got a lot of public data right now that I think shut-ins are occurring, but there hasn't been a lot of public announcements to understand are we anything close to that. I have to say that's a big number. I don't think the voluntary shut-ins are anything close to that at this moment.
We're seeing prices that are so sub-economic. I mean, I wouldn't doubt that the prices go to zero on a regional basis, even negative. And that is a loud siren or a whistle basically saying to producers, stop producing.
Yeah, and we're not too far off that right now. WTI, as you know, has been falling. This is Monday.
Sub 20.
Sub 20 right now. The differentials, unfortunately, last week between Canada and the price of WTI widened, I think because of mm-hmm. concerns around storage. And especially here in Western Canada, we do not have a lot of spare capacity right now, only maybe 5 or 10 million barrels that can be stored. So we had differentials widening for both light and heavy crude. So at this point, Western Canadian Select is, I think it's probably under $4 now. I haven't updated it with the latest WTI, U.S. mm-hmm. dollars per barrel here in Edmonton. Light crude is under $9 a barrel. You might get the odd light producer who's really low cost that maybe can just cover their variable costs
right.
by that, but I would say the vast majority are not.
So let's play this through over time. So we have the demand falling off, consumers not driving, people not flying. So we have a very sudden collapse. The tanks that store these products, jet fuel, diesel, gasoline, start to fill up. That backs up to the refinery. The refinery says, I can't make anymore. There's nowhere to put the product. Signals to the producer, we can't take anymore. So it backs up all the way to the producer. The traders offer a negative price or a zero price, which is a big signal for the producer to shut in. Now let's go the other way. The pandemic starts to be resolved. People start gradually driving again, getting on airplanes. The pull comes. The first pull comes from the big tanks that are full of inventory, which have been maxed out.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to take a time for that to clear out. Then the refineries rev up. Then the call comes for the oil fields to fire up again.
Yeah, you'll get a price signal that will be higher.
Right.
Because honestly, once you shut in these wells, it does cost money to get them going again. And
right.
So I think you will need a fairly decent price signal to motivate those
right.
producers who have shut in
right.
to turn those wells back
is
on
again.
Is
there a chance, do you think, that the producers across North America, because I said this is not a Canada-only problem, it's certainly in the United States, actually it's a global problem, but we'll come to that maybe in a minute, that the producers may overreact collectively and shut in more than is needed? What do you think?
Hard to say. We've never been through something like this. I would say the past has taught us that producers generally do not want to shut in because it costs money to shut in.
Right.
And they will generally hope that the problem will clear and they can just ride it out. Now, this is a very different situation because this does look like it's not just a couple week event, that it will be around for a month or two. And so they may look at it differently. I'd also say in the case of Canada, producers have gone through this process before. They had to go through some of it in 2015 and 16. More recently at the end of 2018, where they looked at the decision, should they shut in? And so it's more of something that they've looked at and accept as maybe a possible solution.
Let's follow this through. What is the future price of oil? It's called the future contracting of oil prices, say a year out. What is it at?
On the strip as of end of day Friday, it would be about $36 a year from now versus the sub 20 we have right now in the spot market, and $40 if you went out 2 years.
$40 2 years out.
This is a WTI.
$36 a year out from now. I mean, that's hardly economic even for a lot of producers. So if you're looking at that real-time market data of what a barrel of oil is trading at for delivery a year from now, I'm thinking to myself as a producer that I'm going to have to probably shut in longer than a few weeks. Because, you know, it's rare in the price of oil for it to fall below 40 for very long, right? And that's why a producer never shuts in, is because they know it can't last very long. So they just keep operating, losing a bit of money mm-hmm. along the way and then getting back.
But thinking they're better off,
right?
Because
right.
they lose more by shutting
in. But if you have this visibility that it's going to be a long-standing thing, I mean, I would argue that, okay, today the price is sub 20, even the price a year out is almost double. I mean, the producer effectively has got to be thinking that, okay, number one, why would I produce my valuable reserves and sell my crown jewels at this ridiculously low price that I know is not sustainable in the long term? And number two, I'm basically going to act as a storage facility because there's a huge premium on storage. In other words, my reserves are my storage.
Yeah, it's a good way to think of it, because how do storage operators think about it, or people that are marketers and traders, they use the storage as a way to play the arbitrages in the market. And here we have an arbitrage where the price a year
right.
from now is worth probably more than the cost
right.
of storage. And so they go buy the crude today, pay for the storage for a year, and sell it a year
yeah.
later. And it's almost, if you locked it in, you'd almost guaranteed
yeah.
your profit. And so why wouldn't the producers think of themselves that way too? And by the way, storage is a premium. It's getting more expensive all the time, and you have storage in your reservoir.
Right. I mean, if you look at this price curve for forward delivery of oil called the futures curve, and you look how it gradually increases over the course of 1 to 2 years to basically doubling in price. I think that, you know, given the shape of that curve and the fact that the oil is worth so much more even a year from now than today, that producers may actually overreact and shut in more.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be a very interesting dynamic, because then you have sort of like this elastic band effect that when the call comes from the refiner to produce, it may take time for the producer to fire up the pump jacks. And I guess that's the wrong word, fire up, but you know what I mean. Like start up.
Get them going, get them bobbing.
Get them going. But
yeah.
you know what I'm saying? Like it's we are in unprecedented times. And you know, this is the article that I wrote last week. That,
yes.
Yeah, we can post that again.
We will, yeah.
That,
it was called, We Need to Think Out of the Barrel.
We Need to
we'll
Think Out of the Barrel.
We'll post that on the show notes.
This unprecedented event is a system shock. And when you have system shocks, that there are unpredictable, unforeseen consequences to what may happen, especially if you let price be the arbiter of you know, who should shut in, who shouldn't shut in, how for how long, and all this sort of thing. Like, it's a very blunt instrument price that does not take into consideration things like energy security, what's it going to take to start up down the road in time, and so on and so forth. So at the moment, the governments, whether here or in the United States, have basically said, okay, we're just going to let price dictate who's going to shut in and how much and over how long. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, and we heard that from Jason Kenney actually on Friday. Doesn't think we need curtailment. It will be done voluntarily. I would say I think there's some value in curtailment immediately in that it would help us draw down those storage tanks, which I think is going to be necessary. We don't know how big these refinery shutdowns are going to be, how fast they're going to come. And we have absolutely no cushion. I would call it like a cushion.
Right.
What is storage? It allows us to take the ups and downs in the market and absorb them by not having them hit us straight on. You know, it cushions the blow. And because we have no space in storage, very little, I would argue that there may be some value in drawing those storage tanks down, anticipating in the next few weeks what's coming. I will say, just as a historical reference, we have never had anything like 20 to 40% cut in our production or our supply in Western Canada. The only thing that comes even close was the Fort McMurray fires in 2016.
Yep.
That wasn't economically motivated.
Right.
We saw about a 20% cut, but we've never seen anything close to that.
Okay. Yeah. So we've got a rough, I would say, 2-3 weeks ahead of us where the storage tanks are filling up and the price signals screaming out to producers that they need to start shutting in. So that's what's going to be happening over the course of the next 2 to 3 weeks. That obviously throws the industry into disarray, not only here, but across the border. But let's focus on here. What are some of the federal government programs and things that are coming up?
Well, on Friday, we finally had some news about part of the Canadian federal government's programs. And this really ties into your commentary about why we need to think out of the barrel. And you were basically making the argument it's easy for people to maybe be dismissive about what's happening to the oil and gas industry in Canada and say, oh, the free market should take care of it. But you're basically saying this is a totally different story. This is stopping of all human activity and the demand for their goods. And I think there's a good argument for the government to help all industries in Canada, including the oil and gas industry. And I had a conversation with a reporter from out east last week. And, you know, he felt it was quite different. You know, this was the result of being in the oil industry, an industry that potentially is going to be decline eventually anyway, an industry that is subject to the forces like the OPEC price war, and Canadians need to subsidize this industry. And I would say it's no different than subsidizing the restaurant. Their demand for their product has disappeared temporarily, and we want those restaurants to be there 3 months from now when we're back going out again, and we don't want all the restaurants and coffee shops in the city to be
bankrupt.
Well, I take
it further. I mean, I think the metaphor is more one I've used before in our podcast, and that is one of the food metaphor with farmers. You know, when the farmers all go bankrupt, eventually the impact of that is felt once the pantry empties out, right? But most people are completely removed when they sit down at the dinner table from what the farmer is doing. And so metaphorically, if the industry here, and by the way, even if the United States really starts to go under, in other words, bankrupt as a consequence of all of this, yeah, we can rely on the storage tanks for a while. But then at the end of the day, the realization sets in that continentally, we haven't transitioned away from this product. We're a long way from doing so, and that there's potentially big problems, and all of a sudden it's an energy security issue. Then the realization sets in that actually 400,000 barrels a day of oil that Eastern Canada imports from the U.S. is further augmented by another 500,000 barrels a day that comes from Western Canada and transits through the U.S. pipelines and back up into Quebec and Ontario.
Yeah, we're a key supplier for the refineries in Ontario and part of the supply into Quebec.
So if the system is affected all the way back up to the producer, then eventually the consumer is going to feel it.
Yeah. And this is a temporary problem. This isn't like a systematic problem because oil demand is declining because we're not using cars. No. This is just like what's happening to every business in North America.
Sure.
We've been told to stay home. We're not using some services and businesses, and oil demand is one of them. And we know that there will be an end to this, and we're going to go back to needing oil, and we don't want those companies to not make it through, just like we don't want all these other important Canadian industries and businesses businesses to fail over a 3-month temporary disruption that we're potentially going through. And maybe it'll be longer than that, but a temporary disruption nonetheless. So I liked your article, gave me some good arguments for my conversation. So let's get back to the fact that government has agreed to help small and medium-sized businesses, including oil and gas businesses, with the announcement on Friday. And there was a bit more information about it today. So basically, if you're a business that meets these criteria, and I think the criteria are a little bit unknown right now, but you would be eligible for up to 75% of your wages covered by the government for your employees, up to annual salary of $58,700. And then on top of that, you may be eligible for loans. And for some of the larger companies within the medium and small size, it could be up to almost $6 million of short-term loan with low interest rate. Like, this is really big. When I think of some of the companies, and you've had discussions over the last many weeks with companies that are really in a difficult spot right now, having the ability to pay your employees 75% of their wage up to that amount, as well as getting a short-term loan with low interest to help with your liquidity issues right now, I think these are really well thought out, important policies that would make a big difference to the companies.
Make a huge difference to the oil and gas companies. But I also want to point out that this is not just an oil and gas issue. We know that this is a pan-economic issue. Retailers and restaurants and shops and what have you.
Airlines.
But, you know, we are a resource-based economy. We are a resource-based economy. And even the, you know, I heard this morning in a different podcast that the mining industry, you know, the copper prices have gone through the floor. And so copper mines are going to be shutting in and others. And, you know, our mining industry is also a resource sector that is really under a lot of pressure. So, you know, the federal government programs that are likely to come are probably going to be pan-economic, pan-industrial, and not specific to, you know, just oil and gas and mining and airlines, and so, because this is affecting everything.
Yeah, and I think there is going to be a program announced later on this week for larger companies as well. It's not that that isn't going to be there. I think that's the expectation. Now, when I first heard this, I thought, God, that's going to be expensive. I'm always, like, I appreciate we want to keep people working, want to have people continue to have wages during this difficult time. But then as a taxpayer, what's the bill going to be? And is that going to mean longer term that our businesses are taxed higher? Or, you know, maybe we have a higher sales tax, maybe individuals are taxed more. Like, do you think this is really unprecedented? Never heard of anything like this. And in fact, the government initially came out with just a 10% wage subsidy just a matter of weeks ago. You know, what's your feeling? Do you think that this is the right thing to do to cover this much of people's wages?
Well, I think we have to in the near term. And how we pay for it is open to question, but obviously one way is to borrow from the future. So there are some, you know, some countries are instituting Corona bonds, this is a long-term bonds that borrow from the future to pay for today. I think that you'll probably see similar types of programs here. So we'll wait and see how it's all going to be financed. But, you know, you can't have people without a roof over their heads and without money to buy food. So we have to deal with the situation in whatever industry we're in.
Well, and I also thought another way to think about it is if all of these employers end up having to lay people off, it may be a lot harder for their businesses to get back to their normal state of affairs after this. Yeah. And so, you know, maybe we have very high unemployment rates and the government doesn't get income taxes off all these people for a long time to come. If you look after the financial crisis, it took the United States almost 10 years to get back to the employment levels that they had before the financial crisis. So if this means that more people are working sooner, it could pay back the government because they're going to be paying more income tax in the next five, 6 years than they would have otherwise.
But, you know, right now we're still having a focus on the pandemic itself, how to deal with it. I think, as I said in the opening comments of the podcast, that as we look over to Europe, we're going to enter into a new phase of how to manage the situation, and then eventually think about the exit ramp on how to get segments of society back to work and hopefully to some sense of normalcy sometime before the end of the year.
Well, and I think these type of programs are starting to look beyond the immediate and over into the future, beyond the valley to the other side, you know, thinking that we need to survive, these industries need to survive, the people that work in them need to get to that other side so that they can contribute to the economy on the other side of this. So I think it's positive, and I look forward to hearing more about the larger program as well.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that, you know, if nothing else, the shock and awe phase, I think, is over. And now we're entering into that management phase. And I think the news flow, if we can get past the next couple weeks, will hopefully turn a little bit more positive.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. We'll be back again next week. I'm sure we'll have more to update you on. Thank you for following our podcast. If you liked it, please tell someone else about us and rate us on the app that you listen to.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.